The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition, where on this show we're going to continue on with our description, our multi-part description of our retirement planning philosophy and ultimately the process itself, actually how we do it. So we, in the previous show, show number one on this topic, we discussed kind of the why, how we got into retirement planning, and also why we approach things philosophically the way that we do. And it really, the two key points, if I want to call out as a reminder from the last show, were this whole concept of a minimum dignity floor, those being the required expenses in the categories of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare that no one has proven to us are not experienced by a retiree until they pass away at mortality, that not only are they there, they're going to continue forever and generally do not decline. If anything, they go up in value or size. And that led us to the approach of covering those expenses in particular with resources, we call them secure income sources, that match that same behavior or characteristics in that they go forever. And if they do anything, they increase as you age and will be there for you until your last days on this earth. So there was that concept. And then additionally to that, last time we talked about, this is also one of the driving forces in how we do things in the retirement planning efforts that we pursue, and that is to keep the approach simple, not simplistic necessarily by any means, but simple to understand and follow. And we discussed a bit about the studies done by Harvard and Texas Tech at a couple of different points in time over the past couple decades, supporting the ideas that basically people as they age, particularly retiree age, so as you're into your late 50s, early 60s and beyond, you're going to start to see mental decline to some degree, and in particular the area of your brain that tends to understand financial topics and that type of reasoning and calculations, if you will, understanding the math and what's going on financially with numbers in your life. That area of the brain in particular degrades more quickly than other areas of the brain. And the Texas Tech, that was mostly the Harvard study, the Texas Tech study kind of dovetailed, if you will, on that study and found that people, it was true what Harvard found, but the more concerning piece or an additional concerning piece was that the Texas Tech folks found that you don't realize this mental degradation is occurring. So you, if anything, remain overconfident in your ability to understand and make decisions in the finance, personal finance space of your life. And so for those reasons, that is kind of the academic justification, if you will, for something we already kind of sensed or had a feeling for through our experience here in retirement planning over the past couple of decades. But that's the academic support for our conclusion that we better pick something that an aging retiree can understand and follow, that a super complicated intricate plan that requires great attention to detail and serious decision-making over time can be setting someone up for failure. So with that in mind, that's kind of the summary, the quick 3-4 minute summary of the last show. We're going to continue on with some additional descriptions of our philosophy, and then hopefully by the end of this show, and I think the plan is for us to actually get into the how we do it, the beginnings of. We certainly won't go through the whole process today. That's why we expect to have at least a couple more shows on this topic. But we'll get from the why, which we're going to finish up today, and start getting into the how we actually approach this retirement planning thing.
Right. And I think the why is crucially important. Mm-hmm. And that's what I ended the last show trying to get people to understand, that if you are contemplating doing this yourself and you're a do-it-yourselfer, so if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a do-it-yourselfer. So it's going to be very important if you're doing it yourself, if you're going to be buying software to help you or subscribing to a website to help you, or you might be a do-it-yourselfer, but you want a second opinion. You want to hire an advisor to maybe look over your shoulder, if you will, and make sure you're doing it right. Whatever the case may be, you're going to want to know why that software or that book or that advisor or that website is doing it the way they're doing it. And if you don't agree with the why, the how is not even going to matter. If you don't agree with the why, don't worry about the how. You need to move on and find a retirement planning process and approach with a why that matches your belief structure. And that's why Chris and I, on the previous show and for a good chunk of this show, we want to teach you and explain to you the why. We just didn't come up with our process out of the blue. It's something that evolved and is still evolving. I think you'll agree on that, Chris. Mm-hmm. We're constantly looking to improve and sometimes even change approaches that we may have been doing for years. But because new studies or new analysis or new ways of thinking of things or new software for crunching numbers even more accurately come out, we change some of our process. So it is an evolving, ever-evolving process. But what is pretty set in stone is the why we believe in what we do. So, of course, the big why was in the first show, as Chris just summarized, which is essentially the minimum dignity floor and our belief uncovering it with secure income. And then, of course, the fact that as we age, our ability to understand financial concepts will diminish, and we want to keep something simple. But there are two other whys, maybe not quite as important as the previous two that I listed, but there are two other whys, for a total of four, that caused us to come up with our process. So let's talk about the third one, Chris. And this is one that you have mentioned repeatedly. Goodness, going all the way back to when this was a radio show and not even on iTunes as a podcast, when we were broadcasting live out of Greeley, Colorado, you were pointing out one of the fallacies of a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate or a Monte Carlo statistical approach to retirement, where they're going to give you a probability statistic on whether or not your money will run out or not. To them, the biggest fear or the biggest thing that could go wrong was always the catastrophic loss, the loss that you were going to lose all your money. That to them is their biggest approach. But you used to always point out, correctly, I feel, that it's not just dying with no money or living with no money that is the risk. It is also dying with money, if you will. It is the fact that you will be constraining your fund spending and spending almost in a linear approach in many of these analyses that are provided, where they're going to limit you to whether it is now the new 3% safe withdrawal rate or if it was the 4% one that is more widely known. But you are going to limit yourself or constrain yourself, even in the fund spending, to not overspend. Therefore, you will underspend. And our thought on that, Chris, was fund spending is not linear. It's actually going to go through phases.
Right. And the when I say the, you know, you've got the obvious risk, which is focused on a lot in withdrawal strategy approaches to retirement planning, the risk that is clearly there that people are, in fact, paying attention to and should, to a certain extent, running out of money while you still have life lived. But that's all that's ever been talked about in that approach. What is almost never mentioned is there's also a chance that you'll not just end up dying with money, but dying with a lot of money, excessive money, where if you were still alive one more day and you looked back and you realized, my gosh, look what I'm leaving behind. I unreasonably constrained my spending over time. And people, though, are always pointing out, though, oh, you can't spend more than this every year because we are fearful of you running out. You've got to accept the fact you might end up with a bunch to protect yourself from running out. And I think that's a false choice. It's a false choice because if you approach things differently, you can more aggressively spend your money while still protecting against running out before you pass away. And that's the balancing act where we're kind of changing the approach or changing the formula there, getting away from this pure withdrawal strategy, which at its core has, and I agree, there's people who are kind of making nuanced changes to this, but for the most part, it's based upon this linear thinking for spending. It's linear other than taking into consideration inflation. So the 4% withdrawal approach or the 3% or whatever number you want to put on it, but that withdrawal strategy essentially models things as if you're going to spend exactly the same amount or withdraw the exact same amount every single year, with the only adjustment over time being inflation. And while there might be some expenses that you're going to fund with withdrawals that behave similar to that, I will give you that. There are certain expenses that actually behave very much like that. Take property taxes, for instance. They just kind of trudge along, going up at a fairly predictable, compared to other things, a fairly predictable inflationary rate. And so they just trot along and behave a lot like that. However, treating all expenses the same is the underlying issue I have with all of this approach, this very, what I would call, simplistic approach. It's not just simple. I will admit it's simple, but it's simple and simplistic. It's too simplistic. It's so simplistic that I believe it's the wrong approach. And that approach is keeping things so simple that you're treating all expenses as the same. They're interchangeable. In other words, the importance and behavior of your property tax expense is treated exactly the same degree of importance, and we assign it the same behavior as you're spending on travel or cruises or eating out or entertainment. And I think that they're fundamentally, that is a terrible conclusion or a terrible foundation to plan from. They aren't the same. They don't behave the same. They shouldn't behave the same, because that is so counter to how humans actually behave, or at least want to behave, in retirement. They don't want to constrict themselves and say, well, the 65-year-old, we're going to spend exactly the same amount on travel, aside from inflation, as the 95-year-old. Well, I think that's asinine. I think that's crazy. Because what that's going to do is going to put the constraints of spending of a 95-year-old on the 65-year-old. And the 65 and 95-year-old are not the same in their desires, their abilities to actually do things like travel. The 65 and 95-year-old are experiencing and dealing with property taxes the same. So you can treat them as such. But something as different as travel, what we call fun stuff, is very different. And the safe withdrawal rate and Monte Carlo simulation and just projecting a fixed amount being spent every year with inflationary pressures is ignoring this fact. And it's ignoring it to the detriment of retirees. People who are retired, who are fitting their lives into this behavior, I think, are costing themselves fun, experiences, life lived to its fullest extent that could be satisfied with all these resources you've spent all the last decades amassing.
And that's exactly why we came up with our approach. We borrowed from another advisor. I've got to get this gentleman's name who came out with the book with the go-go, slow-go, no-go spending. But we borrowed those terminologies
from him. Is it Bill Myers?
I don't think it was Myers.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Because I think he uses the same terminology.
Yeah. A lot of people use the terminology.
Now, yeah.
But what we're getting at is the notion or the reality that certain expenses, by any measure, not your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, but other expenses that we collectively call fun spending, those expenses will go through, in our opinion, three phases of your retirement. Because let's face it, folks, we all know how retirement ends. We're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. We are growing older and weaker and slower and less healthy. So your fun spending, whether it be travel, that's the word that most people use, because a lot of people, as we age, we do want to travel. Even me, yours truly, who absolutely despises flying, is a little more receptive to doing travel now as I age. But for me, I would really like to continue my fishing trips and my hunting trips and my hiking excursions, because that for me is also fun. But I recognize the 90-year-old me is not going to be fishing, hiking, and hunting like perhaps the 60 or 65-year-old me will when I first enter retirement. That fun spending will go through three phases: go-go, slow-go, no-go. Now, Chris and I did not come up with those terminologies. We're borrowing them. We love them. We think they're perfect. They capture the essence of what we believe. But we don't feel your minimum dignity floor goes through a go-go, slow-go, no-go. There's not a point in your life where, well, I don't need food anymore. Well, I guess there is a point in your life. It's called death when you don't need that. But what we try to get people to understand is minimum dignity floor is very methodical. It's going to increase. It's going to increase at rates of inflation far higher than general consumer price inflationary pressures. And it never ends. Whereas fun spending, when you first retire, it's new to you. It's like a vacation. It's a vacation that hopefully lasts forever, you're thinking. And you want to get out and do things. I know I do. I'd like to go elk hunting twice, maybe not just once. Maybe I'll do two fishing trips instead of one. But I intend to do more when I first retire with the knowledge that something is going to happen. It may be regular aging and I'm just slowing down, or it may be medically driven where it happens a lot sooner. But something will cause me to not be able to do a lot of the fun things that I used to do and now currently like to do. Something will happen and I won't be able to do them anymore, most likely forever. So with that acknowledgement, what we try to do and what we wanted to do as we worked together on this is we wanted to say, okay, let's again say someone came to us. I can't remember from the first show. Did we come up with a hypothetical client yet? Did we design one to walk through?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, let's just pretend someone is retiring with $3 million. $3 million of liquid money. Now, you could have $6 million and be listening to this podcast, or you could have $500,000 and be listening to this podcast. The actual dollar amount is immaterial. The concepts of what you're going to do with the money you have remain the same. But let's just pretend, and maybe you should write this down so we'll remember it on future podcasts. Mm-hmm. We'll say it is a couple, man and woman, or man, woman, doesn't matter to me. But we have a couple retiring with $3 million of liquid available assets, not necessarily total net worth, but just liquid assets available for retirement. And let's just say they're 62 years old. They did a early retirement. Mm-hmm. If 65 to 67 is the traditional retirement age, they're in early retirees. Okay. So if we were working with a couple like that, our process when we're done with it would hopefully, and if you're doing this yourself and listen to the whole series of shows, you'll hopefully be able to do something similar for yourself. The goal, Chris, you would agree, is to be able to ultimately tell those people, out of the $3 million you have, and we'll make this up, well, no, we can't make anything up yet because we want to walk them through the process. Mm-hmm. We ultimately hope to tell them, of that $3 million, how much can they spend without worry on fun things? And then we're going to encourage them to spend that fun money rapidly during the go-go phase. I say often on this podcast, money left over is life unlived. Now, a lot of listeners took that very seriously, especially the time I joked that the last check you write should be to the undertaker and it should bounce.
Right.
Because you're gone, check bounced, boom. People took that literally. There was a couple of angry replies you got saying that.
Well, they said we're not going to try to time it like that, as if we could tell you what day that would be so you could time out that last check. What we've had to clarify to them directly, and then we've mentioned on the show here a few times, is that what we're really talking about, we didn't specify, but what we were meaning is that fun number. Fun number that's left after the rest of your concerns, one big one being your minimum dignity floor expenses, but there's, for other people, there's other concerns they want to address first. Your concerns have been addressed in other ways with those resources, and this bucket of fun money literally is what we're talking about. If it runs out, that just means you have replaced it with hopefully a lot of enjoyment, a lot of memories. You've actually used it to embellish or enhance your life in retirement, and you had the freedom to spend it as quickly as you wanted, knowing that if you exhaust that resource, it only affects the fun. It doesn't affect any of the other things that you're concerned with, so you might want to try to time it even, like what we mentioned, bouncing that last check. Now, again, the chance of you timing even your fun stuff to that degree, it's a bit of a joke, of course. But that does illustrate what I would consider perfect financial or perfect retirement planning, is you somehow nailed it, which is going to be practically impossible to do. But
think of our hypothetical client here, folks. They have $3 million in our hypothetical example. Mm-hmm. But what they don't have is any clarity or confidence or comfort in how much of that money can be spent wantonly early in retirement on fun and how much has to be reserved. And that's what we're going to try to teach you to provide for yourself. But we're also going to explain to you how we do it. So hopefully you might be able to do this yourself, perhaps. But the idea is to teach you to spend money. Listen to our podcast called The Opposite that we did last year, I think in August or July or August or September of last year. But where I tried talking to you that retirement is the opposite of everything you ever knew. You're no longer going to grow another $3 million over your retirement. You're going to consume the $3 million you have. But how do you do that? How do you do it clearly with confidence and comfort in knowing you're spending a lot of money and you're watching your account drop and you're not freaking out? Well, it's the concept called the fun number. And once we help you come up with the fun number, it's to teach you that your fun spending, unlike your minimum dignity floor, is going to go through three phases, and we want you to spend a lot of money during the go-go phase. And, of course, less money during the slow go and even less during the no go. But the idea is, how do you position your money? How do you spend? What is a retirement plan for that $3 million? And the best analogy I have for this is a seesaw. And keep this analogy in mind as you're trying to project your retirement. On one end of the seesaw is the younger you. In our example, the 62-year-old hypothetical client. On the other end of the seesaw is the 92-year-old hypothetical client. The only problem is we don't know, Chris, do we, if there really will be a 92-year-old client on the other end of that seesaw.
We don't know, but there might be, and we have to recognize the fact that there might be, and it might be us, and we might want to not ignore that person in us that could be sitting there at 92, or arguably 102, or
82,
112, or 63. I mean, it's, but yes, it's, there's the potential for the older you to need things from the younger you. The younger you is the one who's generated these resources, and the older you is counting on the younger you, while you have the mental acuity to put a plan in place and really recognize these things, that you'll, in a sense, take care of them. You will take care of them, because at 92, if that hasn't happened, they're really in no position to create new resources to take care of themselves at that point. So there's a lot of reliance on the younger you. And I think this is where people tend to clench up and freak out and get scared to spend money, because they recognize this 92 hypothetical person in and of themselves, that is themselves, is out there, and they don't want to put that person in jeopardy financially. So they are overreacting, in a sense, the pendulum swinging, and constricting themselves, in our philosophy, unreasonably from spending. And ideally, we would find a way to more balance the two. But the only way you're going to allow yourself to take up more of these research as a young person is to have the clarity of your situation and the confidence that you do have something in place for that older you, if you will, on the other side of the seesaw, that will create this kind of emotional freedom. And I would call it also financial freedom. It isn't just dealing with the emotions of it. It's structuring things so financially it's a robust plan, and you see it as such, and that's where the emotions improve, and you give yourself the permission, both financially and emotionally, to spend the money as the younger 62-year-old or 68-year-old, once the older you has been dealt with, if you will, or taken care of.
Taken care of. So anything you do, anything our hypothetical 62-year-old couple does to help them, so they start going up on the seesaw, perhaps spending more on fun things or retiring even earlier, maybe at 60 or 58 instead of 62. Anything we do to help them go up by default can push the older them lower on the seesaw. Conversely, any money that we reserve for the older them, oh goodness, you've got to reserve this for your minimum dignity floor. You have to reserve this for a guaranteed inheritance. You have to reserve this for long-term care. You have to reserve this for a buffer. You have to reserve. Put money aside. Don't spend it on fun things now. Well, that will help the older you go up on the seesaw. That puts protections. You're reserving money for the older you, but that costs the younger you. The younger you is going down.
And I think that's the clarity issue that we start to address early on in our process, which is people don't have the clarity to know how far they need to lift up or support that older you on the other side of the seesaw. It's fine to talk at this high level where, oh, you need to lift them up and reserve some assets for them. But the real question is, how much do you need to do that? The typical retirement planning approach doesn't address this directly, and it just kind of is talked about in vagaries, as if you do this kind of high-level 50,000-foot view and things will just kind of all work out.
Well, in a traditional retirement plan is going to do it with a probability statistic,
right,
and say, well, we're going to control your spending and get your spending to a level, or, and I hate this one, we're just going to finagle your required rate of return and turn it up until it gets to a level that your probability of failure by spending this level amount of money every, this linear, I don't want to say level because it generally will increase for inflation, this linear amount of money every year, if we increase the return to this level, boom, all of a sudden you got a 95% chance that it's going to work.
Right. If it's, he's in the seesaw analogy, that would be for the 92-year-old to go crashing to the ground on the seesaw. You only have a 5% chance of doing it. And Jim and I think that is a terrible approach.
Well, I right? think it is. I personally do. Now, this is our philosophy. Yeah. You don't have to agree with it, but this is our philosophy. What we want to do is teach people how to spend their money. Sometimes people ask me, what do you do? And I usually always say, I'm a retirement planner. But I'm trying to get into the habit now of saying, I teach people how to spend their money. Because it usually is followed with a, huh? And then I just get into, well, I'm a retirement planner. And what we do is we teach people who retire with assets how to consume them, what can be safely consumed and what needs to be reserved. Well, again, follow the analogy of the seesaw. You're going up and down. Retirement planning is nothing more than trying to balance it. Find out what do you guys need to do so the younger you can enjoy and spend what they want, and the older you is taken care of. And each you is going to have to give and take. In some cases, in some instances, the older you is going to have to give and take some, and the younger you is going to have to give and take some. But what we're trying to get you to understand is fund spending, in our opinion, is not linear. It should not be limited to a 4% or 3% now, quote unquote, safe withdrawal rate, because it unnecessarily constrains early spending in retirement on fun. This notion that the older you, the 80, 85, 90-year-old you, is going to consume the same amount of fund spending as the 60, 65-year-old you, we just don't see that playing out in not only our office, but in society as a whole. I don't see my parents, who are 80 and 86, doing what they used to do when they first both retired in their early 60s. They're divorced, so I get two views of it, my mom's side and my dad's side. And neither one of them at their current ages are doing what they used to do. And I think if anyone, Chris, looks at their parents or other family members who are older than them, objectively, they too will see that as they age, they're doing less.
We're doing different things.
Different
and
things,
one thing that's almost universal is the types of things, even a really active 90-year-old, the things they choose to do for these activities tend to be less expensive than things that a 65, 70-year-old person tends to do for activities. It's just an if, and if you sit and think about it and mull it over and you start listing the types of things those two groups would do, you'll see it makes common sense, right? It is. Now, are there exceptions sometimes? Sure. Yeah, there was always exceptions.
Always exceptions.
There's always a 90-year-old that's in a triathlon and traveling the world to do it. That's pretty atypical. But the nice thing about, just not to segue too much, but just to mention it right now, our approach, because it is so detailed and customized to a particular person or couple, if they do have, if they're one of these one-off that has something that's very different than, quote, normal or average, the process accommodates it and deals with it. It doesn't just ignore it and treat everybody like the median, which is another huge failing of the retirement planning industry or financial advising as a whole. Most advice is way too universal. It's not customized enough for each individual's circumstance.
I agree. Okay, so there's another why. Fund spending is not linear. And that's why we came up with our process, and it's our belief. You don't have to believe in all of it. And if you don't believe in it, don't do our process. Don't do it on your own. Don't hire us. Don't hire someone else who claims to have a process similar to ours. You're going to be sorely disappointed if the process and reasoning doesn't relate to you. But we believe passionately in the concept of minimum dignity floor, satisfying it with lifetime secure income, positioning your fund spending with this concept we call the fund number for a non-linear approach, instead to embrace a go-go, slow-go, no-go approach to fund spending, and try to get you to spend a lot more on fun things during your go-go phase, because the likelihood you'll be maintaining that level of spending in your no-go phase is rather slim. And the final why that we came up with our approach is purely emotional. And it impacts everyone differently.
And not our emotions.
No, not our emotions. Your emotions. What you have to understand, especially you do-it-yourselfers, you guys and gals really enjoy growing your assets. You enjoy watching them amass. You may not enjoy saving too much, but you enjoy the asset allocation, the diversification. All you boggleheads out there, go on the Vanguard forums and exchange and swap ideas of the best funds right now and the lowest fees and how much you've earned and the compounding you're getting. And you watch your assets grow. You almost get to the level where you probably consider the portfolio living and breathing. It's a thing. You've nurtured it. It needs you. It needs you to manage it and care for it. And then all of a sudden, you retire. And now you have to look at that portfolio, and God forbid, Chris, you got to hurt it.
Right.
You've got to take from it. After spending 30 years putting in, you've got to consume it and watch it drop. But you've convinced yourself a dropping portfolio is bad. And emotionally, you're loath to spend the money. You created it. Why on God's good earth do you want to hurt it? And you don't want to consume it. We've seen this all the time at different degrees to different people. I've been doing this 21 years. Chris has been with me for over a decade. We've seen this. Some people, it's very minimum on. They'll spend it and they'll find a nickel under the couch and they'll run out the next day and buy a piece of gum with it. And then there's other people who are loath to spend any of it. Sad is, I think there's more of them than the previous. And they don't want to spend their money because it's an emotional block. And they've shared that with us. Emotionally, they don't like to see it going down. So the first thing we start telling our clients, and the first thing you guys have got to start doing as do-it-yourselfers, is stop looking at your portfolio as savings. Stop calling it savings. Stop emotionally getting attached to it as some type of creature that needs your coddling, your attention, your soothing, your management, your allocation. And start calling it what it truly is. This is my deferred spending. Because that's all it is. It is deferred spending. Don't believe me? Give it to someone
who isn't emotionally attached to it.
And tell me what they do.
Yeah.
Give it to someone. Give $50,000 to someone and tell them. You've got two choices. Go buy a new Lexus ES300 or put this in your Vanguard account. I'll be back tomorrow and see what you did. Those are the only two choices you have. Tell me how many people wouldn't have the new car in their driveway.
Quite a few.
It's because you have become emotionally attached to it. The best story I have that relates to this,
just goes back a couple of years, folks. A time in my life where, Chris, I actually had a girlfriend. Oh, nice. You're going to think I'm making this part up.
And it was only 2 years ago.
I did at one point in my life, apparently.
A few times in your life.
A few times in my life, just nothing over the past, God, I don't even want to say. But anyways, back then, a couple of years ago, I was dating a woman named Kate. And I'm a gardener, as you all know. And Kate used to come over and help me garden. And we had a lot of excess things in the garden.
Did you get Kate's permission to tell this story?
Absolutely not. Okay. Next door to us was a younger couple. But to the east of that younger couple is another gentleman named Ryan, who has his own little, well, no, he's got a big, massive, more of an organic type garden. And he grows food for some Boulder restaurants. Anyways, Ryan has pigs.
Nice. My wife wants pigs.
Kate and I would grab veggies from my garden and walk on over to Ryan's, and we would sometimes bring Corbett with us because Ryan has a little pond, and Corbett would swim in the pond. Corbett was my Chesapeake Bay Retriever at the time. Anyways, Kate would take veggies from the garden, go to the little pig's house or pen or whatever you want to call it, and pigs are like dogs. They really are. They wag their little pigtails.
They get to know you.
They
and
get
run
to
right
know
up.
You. They run to you. They listen to you. They don't sit if you tell them to sit, but pretty much they do everything else. And she would feed the pigs. She'd feed the pigs excess lettuce and spinach. They weren't too keen on summer squash, which surprised me, but nonetheless.
So they were picky pigs.
They were picky pigs. And Kate really got attached to said pigs. And she really enjoyed her pigs.
In her mind,
they're her pigs. One day, we went to Ryan's to feed said pigs, and Kate was devastated. You know why?
Did they run away?
They didn't run very far. The pigs met their demise when the pigs weren't in the little pig area. I remember Kate asking Ryan, where are the pigs? And he pointed to his, I'm not sure if it was garage or barn area, where there was this big-ass chest freezer. The pigs were in the freezer. Kate didn't handle it too well. And I will admit, I was bumming too, because I looked at him and I said, you killed the pigs? Because I, maybe not to the degree Kate was, but I became emotionally attached to those pigs, too. It was cute. They used to put their little pig mouth on your hand and take the food out. I didn't realize pigs were quite friendly creatures. Now, not so much the wild hogs running around Texas.
No, that's a different. Yeah.
But these were much more tame and friendly pigs. And Ryan had killed them, and they were in his freezer. And I did say to him, how could you kill the pigs? And he said to me, he said, you hunt, because I gave him some elk.
Right.
And I said, I know I do, but I didn't know the elk. And that's when it dawned on me, and he said the same thing. He says, Jim, I didn't become emotionally attached to those pigs from the day I got them to the day we butchered them. I knew that's what they were. I looked at them as future food. You're the one who came over and wanted to pet them and play with them and feed them. Right. I accepted it, Kate, a little less so, but the pigs were consumed. This little analogy is so true in the sense, folks, I can go harvest an elk and not think twice about it. But I don't have livestock on my property. I could not do what Ryan does because I know I cannot divorce myself from the attachment I would have to an animal. I've got 10 acres of land. I could raise a pig if I wanted to. I choose not to because when it came time for it, I don't think I could go out and put a bullet in its head. Or, hey, let's go for a ride. And the piggy's all excited. Oh, we're going bye-bye. And he jumps into his little trailer or however you get him to the butcher, thinking he's going to go have some fun, and instead he's going to go to a butcher. I couldn't do that. Ryan clearly can, because he did not become emotionally attached. Well, if you've got $3 million like our hypothetical people in our story have, and you are emotionally attached to that $3 million, you're not going to want to see it drop. Now, that's going to really bother you emotionally, so you may not want to spend it. I've seen more problems when it comes to couples. I think you would agree, Chris. One spouse is not really emotionally attached. They're Ryan, if you will. And another spouse is Kate, if you will. And the pig is the portfolio.
Right. Another good reason for communication in a couple.
That's yes.
A lot of good reasons for open communication. Here's another example.
So one of the things you can do is start looking at your portfolio like Ryan looked at the pigs. They were food, not a pet. It is not savings, it's deferred spending. That's what it is.
Yeah, and we like to point, we're pointing this out, we point it out to people all the time just to get them thinking about it. This is something you'll have to come to grips with a bit on your own. We're not going to convince you, we're pointing it out so you can consider it and hopefully come around. If not, you're going to unreasonably constrict your spending, if you will, and if you can't get over that, so there's an emotional hurdle, you'll have to go over it. There is a related emotion, too, that I think our process does address directly, and that's the emotions of worry, the emotions of worrying about it dropping too fast. Maybe because there are people that they certainly have that emotional response, and it's not because they love the portfolio and are loath to seeing it go down. They're just worried it's going down too fast. And that's where a good process with a good philosophy and reasoning behind it at the end will provide you with the clarity and the confidence that it's not going down too fast, that you can remove that worry from yourself. So there's, I just want to throw that other emotion out there too, because it's still related to portfolio dropping.
Absolutely.
But I think it's for a different reason than you're mentioning. The one you're mentioning, I'm glad we bring it up all the time, because I think it's healthy. Not, but we're starting to sound like therapists here. It's healthy to address this and to kind of get your mind and emotions turned around prior to retirement, that this is deferred spending. You've worked. Why did you work putting this all away? It wasn't to put it on a shelf and admire it. It was to eventually consume it and wrapping your mind and emotions around that and giving yourself the emotional freedom to spend it. And then really it's just a matter of how am I going to spend it so I can still remain emotionally healthy and not be freaked out that it's going down too fast or that it's I'm using it incorrectly or this, that, or the other thing. The last thing I'll mention too is this is all consistent and appropriate for people who work under kind of the direction we're describing here. We clearly are not empire builders. We are not designing a process and an approach for you to build an empire and pass wealth, growing wealth, generation after generation after generation. If that's the goal, for you to live an austere life so that you can leave as the most money possible to your kids, our approach and philosophy is not consistent with that. That's not our what we've designed. Now, could we design one? I have no interest in doing so, but we would design a completely different process and approach for someone who had that goal in mind. So if when we say the goal is to spend it all, if you're sitting there thinking, oh, no, my main goal, not that you can't have some dedication to leaving something behind. That's certainly part of our process. We call it a recognizing there's a commitment to a guaranteed inheritance or a guaranteed charitable donation or fill in the blank there. We could certainly be part of our story, but if it is, I want to leave the abs, that's the number one goal, to leave as much as possible, and then I'm going to encourage my kids to do the same for my grandkids so that after I've been dead for three or four generations, they're going to put my picture above the fireplace in the mansion and say, oh, look, he started this whole trend, and now we are the modern day Rockefellers or fill in the that similar blank to that. So just a few thoughts on
I fully agree on that, and it's important to recognize that our when I tell you to look at your portfolio and get you to understand it's deferred spending, parts of that portfolio are going to be deferred a heck of a lot longer than other parts. And that's what the actual process, when we start getting into that in the next show, walking you through the process, you're going to see how you can go from 3 million and begin to whittle it down to what are you going to need to protect your minimum dignity floor, and how do we come up with that amount? And then what do you need to reserve for aging, for taking care of yourself as you grow old? Or are you going to not do any of that? And then what are you going to do about a guaranteed inheritance? Is that important to you? Do you want to make sure your children inherit a certain amount, or your church, or a charity, or all three? If so, how much? And what's the best way of positioning to do that? But that too is going to whittle your $3 million down. And then once you take care of aging and a guaranteed inheritance, do you want to build a buffer? Do you want to put some money aside in case something goes wrong? That's the fourth element, the fourth reduction, if you will, from your initial retirement pool of $3 million. So when you're finally done, you will have our approach, or a reasonable approach, if you will, to what we call your fund number. And it's that money, it's that deferred spending, if you will, that's going to be deferred for the shortest amount of time. Or at least a chunk of it will be deferred for the shortest amount of time, because it's going to be consumed immediately upon retirement in your go-go years. But that's the process, or at least the lineage approach that we're going to do, to take the $3 million to reserve or whittle it down for minimum dignity floor, aging, guaranteed inheritance, buffer. And when all those are done, the only spending we haven't helped you address is the fund spending. The remaining money is your fund money. And if that's enough money to fund your fund spending, then you can enter retirement. If there's not enough, you've got to grow more, either by working longer or cutting your fund spending to smaller amounts where your assets would support it. But that's the basics of our approach, but it's the why that's important. Why? We believe in the minimum dignity floor, which will continue for the rest of your life. We believe in covering that minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed secure income of Social Security, pension, and income annuity if needed. We believe that your fund spending should not be planned for in a linear approach. It should be planned for in a go-go, slow-go, no-go phase. And then we believe that you need to start emotionally preparing yourself as soon as possible for the consumption of those assets, the spending of them, the butchering of your pig, if you will, and not fall victim to, oh my God, that's such a cute little pig, I'm going to nurture it. Because when you're not there protecting that pig anymore and nurturing it, someone else is going to come in and eat it. That pig is going to get eaten. That portfolio is going to get spent, or the pig is going to be eaten, whichever way you want to look at it. And if it's not going to be spent by you, it'll be spent by someone else. It is deferred spending. What you're really wondering is how much needs to be deferred past your retirement age, past 62 in this example, and how much can begin to be consumed at 62. There's some that you're going to consume right away, and others that you need to save. We're going to get into that level. We're going to move from the why in the next show to the how. I had hoped to get into the how today. Doesn't look like it. We've got a client coming in real shortly, Chris. Looks like another 15, 17 minutes. 13 minutes, goodness. So we're going to have to wrap this up. So we're going to get to the why. Excuse me, we already did the why. We're going to get into the how in the next series of shows. But these first two shows, listen to them again to see if the why makes sense to you. If it doesn't make sense, don't listen to the next couple of shows where we get into the how. But if it does make sense, wow, I understand what these guys are saying. It makes sense to me. Then I think you'll benefit when we start getting into the how. But please never lose sight of the why. If you are doing it yourself, hiring a person or working electronically through artificial intelligence and the web on trying to project your retirement, always try to find out why. Why are you going to do it the way you're doing? Before you tell me I can retire, tell me why you're going to do it the way you're doing it. Because if I don't agree with the why, I don't give a damn about the how, I'm moving on. You've got to find a retirement process whose why matches your beliefs.
Right. And we are, just for so you know, we are going to divulge our how.
We're not hiding it from you.
No, we feel free to do that because, well, remember how I said the results and the path that we're going to draw out for people is relatively simple, but it's not simplistic. And when people see what all it goes into the how, there's going to be a few people that say, yeah, let me try that myself. I'm willing to dedicate 150 hours or whatever it would take someone doing it for the first time to do all these things that Chris and Jim are describing in their how, because I bought into their why, it makes perfect sense, and I'm going to do it myself. You could. We'll give you enough detail where you could actually take that approach if you wanted to. And although, obviously we do this professionally, the reason why we can tell you our how is because most people aren't going to want to go through the effort and level of detail that actually it takes to put this all together. But we will. So those of you in doubt that we're going to reveal our secret sauce, if you will, we'll give it to you. We're going to give it to you. We'll describe it. Maybe not down to the penny, but we're going to give you enough where you could actually follow it on your own if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think the hardest part for people who are going to try to do it on their own, which, again, we have no problem with people doing it on their own, is going to be getting the numbers they need. The number crunching is going to be the hard part. I don't know of any consumer-facing software or consumer-facing website. One of the reasons, a sad reason, that probability statistics, safe withdrawal rate, retirement projections are probably what 80-90% of retirement plans are based on, is because they're so damn easy.
And there's existing software that does all the work for the planner.
But the calculations are so relatively easy.
Yeah, they are very straightforward. Once you design the basic engine, it's click this,
how much you're going to earn,
15 minutes,
how much you're
going
to spend, mm-hmm. What's inflation,
yeah.
Click here. As if your retirement, as if the last 30 years of your life are so simplistic, they can be done with a few mouse clicks. But one of the reasons safe withdrawal rate and probability statistic is so popular, it is so incredibly easy. There are dozens of programs out there. I would say there's probably dozens of consumer websites out there that will also do it for you on a probability Monte Carlo linear approach to retirement. But again, listen to the past two shows. You'll understand why we don't like that. We believe in a different approach to retirement. But our approach isn't easy. I think the biggest problem a lot of you do-it-yourselfers are going to have as we start telling you how we do this is trying to get the numbers. Now, some of you are wicked good in Excel. I'm not. We got people here like Chris and Scott and even Joe. Joe is actually better in Excel than I even imagined. Are really good at programming Excel, and maybe you could use Excel. I'm real lousy in Excel, so I just hire people who know how to do it. But we don't use Excel to crunch our numbers. We use very advanced planning software that is not available in the retail world. I don't know.
But the reason why is that it would be difficult to write a tool that is applicable to all the different types of clients a professional might run into. If you're just designing it for yourself, it'll be easier, but it's still going to be, when we say easier, not easy for sure. If you're really going to do justice to the number crunching, you're going to have to put forth a lot of effort by hand and or something like Excel in order to get these projections and forecasts in a reliable enough way to draw reasonable conclusions. So we are, those of you who don't want to do it yourself and are interested maybe in the services that we provide, we are practicing financial planners, focusing on specializing, if you will, in retirement planning. We're here in Northern Colorado, but we service clients throughout the entire country. If you're interested in finding a little bit more about what we do, you can find our website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can reach out to us. There's also a little calendar or scheduling app where you can schedule directly what we call a coffee and a second opinion, was where we'll spend 30 to 60 minutes with you and chat a little bit about our process and our approach, and you can share what your situation is, what your concerns are, and we can discuss if what we provide we feel would be of benefit to you, and talk some more specifics about what you're asking for, what it would cost to deliver such a thing to you, etc. But we call that coffee and a second opinion. That's free of charge. And right on the website, jimhelps.com, you can learn a little bit more about that. Also learn a little bit more about those of us here. We have some summary information about our process there as well. Not as robust as what you're hearing in these shows. So this resource that we're trying to lay down here in the series of 4 to 5 shows of EDU shows specifically is really going to reveal the secret sauce. It's going to reveal our philosophy, which we've done the past couple shows, and then the next few shows are going to be the process and steps themselves in order to deliver what we've been talking about philosophically. So thanks everybody for listening. We will be back with you with the next step here in our next new show.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.